The National Archives podcast series. This talk is called Reflections on the Reformation. Speakers on this panel include Dermot McCulloch, Alexandra Walsham, and Jonathan Willis. It was recorded on Friday, the 13th of April 2018 at the National Archives, Kew.
Well, good evening, everyone. It's wonderful to see so many of you here today for this unique event. You're all very welcome. My name is Dr. Marianne Wilson, and I've developed the Reformation programme here at the National Archives for the past 18 months. And something that I've been working very hard to do is to raise awareness of the breadth of our Reformation-related collections here. So last year, the National Archives commemorated the 500th anniversary of what is widely considered to be the starting point of the Protestant Reformation in Europe, the production of Martin Luther's 95 Theses in Wittenberg, Germany, as well as a series of blogs, academic and public talks, an exhibition of original documents relating to Martin Luther in the Keeper's Gallery, and a panel exhibition showing a selection of material from our collections. The highlight of our commemorations was a two-day academic conference, which some of you may have attended. This was held in November 2017 and brought together early career researchers and scholars researching the Reformation using original records of church and state from our collections. Of course, many international, national, and local institutions commemorated the Reformation anniversary last year, and so now that the dust has settled a little, we thought it would be a pertinent opportunity to reflect on the Reformation and why it is such an important part of our national history, and also to think about how the surviving documentary evidence for the Reformation has shaped our perception of how these events unfolded. So I'm delighted to welcome to the National Archives an absolutely stellar lineup of speakers for our panel discussion and debate this evening, who almost need no introduction. Dermot McCulloch is Professor of the History of the Church in the Theology Faculty at St. Cross College, Oxford. He's a Fellow of the British Academy, and he's written extensively on Tudor England, including his biography on Thomas Cranmer and his forthcoming biography on Thomas Cromwell, which is due for publication in September 2018. Alexandra Walsham is currently the principal investigator on the AHRC-funded project Remembering the Reformation, and her books include The Reformation of the Landscape, Religion, Identity and Memory in Early Modern Britain and Ireland, and she recently delivered the Ford Lectures at Oxford. And Professor Walsham has been at Trinity College, Cambridge since 2010. And Dr. Jonathan Willis specialises in the history of the Reformation with interests in the theology of early modern Europe. He's director of Birmingham Centre for Reformation and Early Modern Studies, and his publications include The Reformation of the Decalogue, Religious Belief, Practice and Identity, and The Ten Commandments in England, and this was published last year. And some of these volumes are available in our bookshop. So the structure of the evening will be as follows. Each speaker will give their own 10-minute reflection on the Reformation. We will have a short period of questions, discussion and debate. So if we could begin with our first speaker, Professor Dermot McCulloch.
Going first, I think my job is to do a big picture. And the first thing to say about the English Reformation is it is on the fringe of Europe. England was a comparatively unimportant country in the 16th century. It was a fringe in Europe, and therefore its Reformation is basically borrowed from elsewhere. The English had no original theological ideas. They didn't contribute anything of distinction in the Reformation. And therefore, you've got to look to the wider picture to understand this as a religious event. They're borrowing all their theological ideas, with the one exception that they've had an attempt at Reformation before the Reformation, which failed. the Lollard movement of the late 14th century, going into the 15th, surviving into the 16th. So there is a movement of dissent with which the Protestant Reformation then interacted. But Protestant Reformation, now there's a problem, because Protestantism is not a seamless garment. It's easy to think of the Reformation as Protestant versus Catholic, but it wasn't, because very early on, in the 1520s, Protestants started disagreeing violently about what Protestantism was. On the one hand, you've got Martin Luther, and you might say that on the other hand, you've got everybody else. So Luther created something which came to be called Lutheranism, and there were certain parts of Europe which became Lutheran. But as early as the first 5 years of the European Reformation, there were other voices, to start with in the great Swiss city of Zurich and other great Swiss cities, ultimately also in a city which wasn't part of Switzerland but now is, Geneva. And this group of thinkers, pastors, theologians, took different lines from Luther on very fundamental questions, such as what is the Eucharist? What's going on when you take bread and wine? Luther, like the Pope, thought that when you took bread and wine, you can turn them into the body and blood of Christ. Now, these other theologians begged to differ. Instead, they said that this is a symbol of the body and blood of Christ. Bread and wine, it remains still. So there's a huge difference straight away. And all sorts of other things. One of the most important of which, I think, is whether you think it is distracting and dangerous to have beautiful things in churches. Luther thought, not a problem. Other reformers very quickly said, yes, these things are dangerous. They get between you and God. Therefore, they must be destroyed. And they started destroying them. And so your theologians in Zurich did this, in Basel, and later in Geneva. And Luther, partly because they had done this, disagreed furiously and kept the beautiful things in churches. So we've now got two different sorts of Protestantism disagreeing on such fundamental things. Well, we've already found a name for one sort of Protestantism, Lutheranism. What can we call the others? Well, I don't think it's a very inspiring name for a church to call it non-Lutheran. The non-Lutheran church meets at 11 o'clock on Sundays. No. We've got to find a name for them. And they thought of a wonderful piece of one-upmanship for their name. They call themselves Reformed. And that wasn't just a criticism of the Pope, it was a criticism of Luther. So from the 1520s, we're getting two blocks in Europe, Lutheran and Reformed, a name which wouldn't settle down till later. So, the English on the edge, which are they going to go for? Which are they going to opt for? Well, to cut a very long story short, and my colleagues will probably open that up, the eventual identity of the English Church, the Church of England, became Reformed, not Lutheran. And that became apparent particularly in the reign of King Edward VI, but also in the reign of Queen Elizabeth. The church in England had detached itself from Rome for all sorts of reasons, but now another element came in as well. The preferences, the private preferences of English leading churchmen, and also of those who wished for a real reformation. One of the documents is a Star Chamber case of the early 1560s, in which the issue is whether you should smash up a church in Suffolk because its interior is full of objects of superstition. And one side, in fact the radicals, the reformed people, brought a Star Chamber case against those who thought it was a very bad thing to destroy tombs and screens in the Church of Bures in Suffolk. That's one document which begins to show you that it's not just the monarchy which has opinions on this. It's ordinary people, and it's also the leading bishops of the Church of Elizabeth I. Elizabeth, by temperament, was sort of a Lutheran. She had a strong idea of what happens in the Eucharist, the body and blood of Christ is there. She loved beauty in churches, and therefore she's actually at odds with her own Reformation. It became emphatically reformed. So it lined up with Geneva and the church, the Protestant church in the Netherlands and Hungary and Poland, not with the Lutherans. So why then the Church of England as it is now, which looks curiously much more like Lutheranism than it does like the Reformed? Well, here the secret weapon of Queen Elizabeth I was to keep cathedrals, and not just keep cathedrals as Lutheran churches did, as big churches belonging to a bishop, but all the bang shoot of all the things that cathedrals had always had: choirs, organs, prebendaries, close. And the cathedral worked its subversive magic within this reformed system. It gave it a second identity, which you might all simply call Catholic, because all the things that cathedrals did were not emphatically reformed things. They had a regular round of ceremonial worship performed by professionals, which concentrated on beauty and said that this was a good way to worship God. So the person deciding that crucial difference in the Church of England was Queen Elizabeth I, a personal decision on her part. She loved church music. Her own private chapel, the Chapel Royal, was full of splendid musicians, some of whom were actually Roman Catholics. And so the Queen herself subverted her own Reformation. And the rest is history, as they say. We ended up with something called Anglicanism, a word more or less invented in the 19th century to describe the puzzle of this reformed Protestant church gone to the bad. And I'll leave it there.
Thank you very much for that, Dermot. If we'd like to move on now to Alex's contribution and reflection.
Thanks very much. I want to reflect more about the National Archive as a source for the study of the Reformation. When the National Archive was established as the public record office in the 19th century, that reflected a desire to create a central repository of documents of official public bodies, and to also create a kind of repository of the nation's textual heritage and patrimony. And it was linked closely with trends in historical writing, which were in pursuit of facts, empirical, positivist facts. And so it was very much a place that where people went to look at the legal, the political, the administrative history, which was what was regarded as important kind of history. And it's not surprising that scholars have long turned to the National Archives, because for a long time it was recognized and thought of as very much an event from the center, as Dermot has talked about. It was a top-down process, a political and a legislative event that involved unraveling the connections between the Church of Rome and of England. So it was natural, therefore, that historians made it one of their first ports of call, and it shed light on legislative processes, administrative policies, what Geoffrey Elton called the Tudor Revolution in government, and how that was connected with the process of Protestantization. In the 1970s, historians started to think in different ways about the Reformation, and they particularly started to want to try to understand what happened at the grassroots and at the local level. And that inspired a turn towards local archives to look at how this Reformation had been received. And that process led historians to think of it increasingly less as a fast political process than as a slow and often unwelcome process that people resented, resisted, and grudgingly complied with. Now, subsequent trends in the study of the Reformation have been more to try to find a kind of social and a cultural history of the Reformation, to find the voice of lay people rather than those politicians and churchmen making the policies and imposing them upon them. So we've begun to think about the Reformation as something that was not done to the English people, but something that was done with them in a process of mutual negotiation and collaboration. Now, I want to just say something, make 5 points about how and why I think it is that new scholarly trends should make us turn back to the National Archives and to look at it and its sources in a new light. And the first is that historians are increasingly interested in material culture. And you've seen some of the documents that talk about this, the way in which the Edwardian state is very concerned to stop people embezzling church goods, but also in order to be able to appropriate those goods for itself. We're used to thinking of Henry's reign as the reign of a rapacious king, but actually those documents on the Edwardian inventories reveal just how rapacious Edward's regime was as well. But what they reveal too is something very concrete about what was in churches and what was lost as a result of the Reformation. The second thing is that public records can provide us, perhaps surprisingly, with insight into personal and private attitudes. Some historians now speak of autobiography in a very broad sense, and they find the voices of ordinary people in all sorts of documents like parish registers, church wardens' accounts, administrative records that provide access to ideas and a form of personal perspective on the events if one reads them carefully. And they also give us insight too into what Natalie Zeman Davis once called fictions in the archives. We think of the National Archives as a repository of facts, but actually there's plenty of fiction and storytelling in the archives as well. The third point is that I think the National Archives can also unexpectedly provide us with insight into the history of the family. One of the documents I suggested we bring out is from SP46, the collection of letters of the Johnson family, an evangelical merchant family, which I'm just told came into the National Archive because that family went bankrupt and its property and papers were confiscated. And we learn from the Johnson family's letters something about that very tumultuous period between 1542 and 1552, when there's change, significant change at the end of Henry's reign into Edward's reign. And we learn something about our family, how it experienced and negotiated those changes. The fourth thing that I think the National Archives can offer us further insight into, and that reflects new trends in scholarship, is the history of memory itself, how the Reformation was remembered. And we can see this in various ways. One, in some of the records of the Equity Courts, the Exchequer records, we find in there the depositions of ordinary people later in the 16th century in various disputes over custom, property, various things, looking back to the time before the Reformation, what was known as Abbey time, the time of the monasteries, as it were. And we get some insight into how otherwise people who have not left a mark on the record, how they responded and how they remembered and what they forgot about that process of tumultuous and turbulent change. One of my favourite examples is from a Star Chamber case in which a gentleman called Henry Moore was indicted for a quite extraordinary rant against the Tudor dynasty, and particularly Henry VIII, who he said was a tyrant, a perpetrator of sacrilege, and that the Protestant religion had sprung out of his codpiece. So we get some very strong sense of a seditious and an alternative memory of the Reformation other than the official one, which the National Archives is, you know, as it were, created to perpetuate and cement. So the fifth and final point I want to make is about a renewed and growing interest among scholars in the history of archives themselves. And that's part of a renewed interest in institutions, in bureaucracy, in how records and archives came into being themselves. And whereas the 19th century thought about an archive as a kind of neutral repository of fact, we're increasingly aware of the extent to which such institutions are themselves projections of ideological preoccupations, of confessional concerns, and of the very processes that we study as historians of the Reformation. So they tell us something about how Protestant narratives about the late medieval and early modern past came into being, and how they were shaped and constructed to perpetuate an official story that vindicated the destruction of the late medieval church and that kind of glossed and spun accounts of how it had been dismantled in the 16th century. So to that extent, this building and this collection is a kind of monument to the Tudor state's own attempts to control its legacy and how it was remembered, and how it also sought to engineer kinds of forms of forgetting and oblivion. So we need to pay attention not just to what's here, but to what was thrown away, what was not preserved, what was discarded, because all of that is itself political. It's part of the story that we're telling. We only see the Reformation through the lens and the spectacles of what survived. So we need to think about how those things came into being. And I think that kind of archival turn is something that calls upon us as historians to engage in much more collaboration with curators and archivists, and that's where I want to end.
Thank you. Well, that touches on some of the things that Dermot was talking about. Over to you, Jonathan.
Thank you very much. So yeah, my comments, I've sort of split into three sections really. I want to talk a little bit about the records of the Reformation in general, and I want to talk about their relevance today, and the relevance of the records, but also the relevance of the Reformation. What are some of the main legacies of the Reformation? Why is this something that we should still care about and want to find out more about? And then finally, to think a little bit about the impact of the 1517 anniversary. Marianne sort of began by saying, you know, part of the reason for this cycle of events hosted by the National Archives is marking sort of 500 years since Luther perhaps apocryphally hammered, nailed his 95 theses to the door of the castle church in Wittenberg. Why is that anniversary a significant one? Why has it perhaps not been marked with more fuss here in England? So a few thoughts and then sort of a brief concluding thought. So to start off by thinking about the records of the Reformation, the changes and processes which accompanied and constituted the Reformation of the 16th century generated an enormous to advance the practice of historical writing altogether. The question of what happened in the past and being able to say with authority what had happened in the past was sort of a key plank of the mission of the Reformation, to try and say certain things about the history of the church, how it had developed over the centuries, to claim that their interpretation was right and that the interpretation of the institutional Catholic Church and of the papacy was wrong. So history, interpretations of history were very much at the centre of the Reformation project from its earliest years. And the Reformation was a process, not just a religious process, but has already been hinted, was a political process, was a social process, was a cultural process, impacted on pretty much every aspect of life or pretty much everybody in the course of the 16th century. So examples of the sort of material that historians turn to from this period to tell the story of the Reformation, things like Acts of Parliament, so we've got the fantastic 1534 Act of Supremacy, that the sort of the capstone of the series of legislation which gradually separates the Church of England as it becomes from the wider sort of communion of the Catholic Church, later, you know, as it becomes thought of as the Roman Catholic Church. So Acts of Parliament, official publications, treatises, these kinds of things were perhaps from the earliest years one of the sort of one of the go-to resources for telling the story of the Reformation, as has been commented on, a sort of a top-down sort of political process. Other sources which have been invaluable to historians include the sort of background political activity of the government, the inner workings of politics from the time. Things preserved in the so-called letters and papers of Henry VIII, the state papers, the letters of people like Thomas Cromwell in the reign of Henry VIII or William Cecil in the reign of Elizabeth I. And we were just sort of commenting earlier between ourselves that often you only have one half of this correspondence. You might have all the letters that come in or all the letters that go out, and you often, you know, struggle to kind of match up both sides of a conversation. But still, those kinds of documents are incredibly important. We also, of course, looked at the records of the church itself. Centrally, things that sort of come out, the records of the meetings of convocation, the sort of the parliament of the church, if you like, and also records generated at diocesan and parish levels. So as Alex said, one of the sort of turns towards a more sort of parochially informed history of the Reformation used things like visitation articles and injunctions, church wardens' accounts, which were literally lists of the expenses, you know, the money coming into the parish and the expenses which come out of the parish, and include things like money paid for whitewashing the walls and obliterating images, or money for removing the stone altar and bringing in the wooden communion table to replace it. So through those kinds of documents we gain huge insight into what's going on at the parish level. Print is an incredibly important record for us in telling the history of the Reformation. Official, polemical, theological, pastoral texts, biblical editions, because of course the Reformation is very much a movement predicated on the Bible and the authority of the Bible, and people having access to the Bible in the vernacular, not only the Bible, but also particular parts of the Bible. The Reformation, one of the sort of odd things that it ushers in is the sort of birth of congregational singing in the vernacular. And in England, that congregational singing takes the form of not hymns, because Reformed Protestants believe you shouldn't make up words, you should use the words of Scripture when you're singing in church. So they take the Book of Psalms and they convert them into a sort of a metrical rhyming form, and this is a sort of a huge popular success in the Reformation, the congregational singing of vernacular metrical psalms. We get other forms of print, ballads, woodcuts, etc. And then moving sort of beyond the realms of officialdom, wills, diaries, private letters, and then other forms of document which aren't documents at all. So music, visual images, material culture, buildings, the landscape, which Alex Walsham has told us so much about. So the sheer quantity and variety of material that we can use to tell the history of the Reformation is almost limitless. And as Alex has already said, as well as paying attention to what there is in the archives, you know, we do need to be attuned to the silence in the archives. So whose voices do we hear when we go to the archive? Whose voices do we not hear? Often, if we're not careful, we sort of hear lone voices shouting very loudly. And we've got to be careful not to give those undue weight and miss out on the silent conforming majority. And actually, you know, what do those voices we don't hear, what do they have to tell us about the course of the Reformation? One of the biggest challenges of Reformation studies, but of history in general, are questions of sort of preservation and survival, destruction, editing, literacy. You know, we sort of, a lot of the records that we have from things like Star Chamber are records of deviance, of criminality, of aberrant behaviour that are only recorded because they came outside of the usual sort of scope of acceptable activity. And we also need to be aware that the way that records have been preserved and the way that we're able to access them and view them affect the histories that we write. So brilliant things like the digitization of printed sources means that it's very easy to, you know, sort of put in a keyword on a computer and search for it and bring up a lot of references to it. But to do that, you lose a sense of the original context, the sort of the physical material properties of the text that language, those words that are sort of held within. Moving on to, to relevance. I mean, the relevance of the records, I mean, these are the stuff of historical writing. You know, without this stuff, we all out of a job, quite frankly, I think. Historical writing hopefully informs broader historical knowledge through sort of crossover books, documentaries, novels, TV and film adaptations, public lectures and podcasts, blogs, writings in newspapers, magazines, and that sort of thing. And that's something that, I don't want to get too bogged down by this, which is quite tedious, but you know, the idea that historians, professional historians in universities, have a duty to talk to people outside of the university context is increasingly a sort of a truism that I think we're all foolish not to embrace. The relevance of the Reformation itself, and this is something I always ask my students at the end of our sort of term-long module on this, you know, what ripples of the Reformation are still sort of visible in the world around us today? Well, the religious tensions in Europe are formative in the colonisation and character of North America, and if you think about the role of religion in US politics, I mean, I think we can see the Reformation reflected there. Obviously, it's evolved a bit since then, but the Reformation sees the collapse of a monolithic religion and the growth of pluralism, leading on the one hand to toleration and on the other hand to Christian sectarianism and religious violence. If we look at events like the French Wars of Religion, the 30 Years' War, the English Revolution, and projecting more into the future Northern Ireland sectarianism, these are all, in a sense, inheritances of the Reformation. And a particular legacy in England of anti-Catholicism. And if you think it's not until the 19th century that the Roman Catholic Relief Act in 1829 repeals a lot of the sort of punitive legislation which has been put in place against English Catholics. There were also sort of more subtle shapings, I guess, of English national and cultural identity. We had the 400th anniversary of the King James Bible, you know, a couple of years ago. If we think of the way that the language and cadences of the Book of Common Prayer and the Bible have sort of entered into the English language. Also perhaps a sense which develops from the Reformation of England as a nation apart, sort of specially favoured by divine providence. I mean, this is maybe something that we still have echoes of in certain discourses. Moving on to wrap up on the impact of the 1517 anniversary, I mean, this was huge in academic circles, a massive spur to new publications, biographies of Luther, lectures, conferences, perhaps a little more muted in the broader public sphere, but I think there was still a big awareness in newspapers and in sort of scheduling on TV, that kind of thing. Much more muted compared to what was going on in Germany, where they had a whole decade of celebrations, a Luther decade, building up to 2017, picking different themes of sort of Luther's legacy each year and sort of looking at these in turn, organised much more proactively and centrally, I think, by the state and the church sort of, together. Why was there not more of a fuss here? Well, 1517 was simply not a part of our national story in the same way as sort of Luther was for Germany, I guess, for reasons that Dermot has already told us about. I think we forget at our peril that there was a Reformation, you know, before Henry VIII's marital difficulties, but I think that's what fixes in a lot of people's minds, that it's not really until that point that things sort of get going. Perhaps there's confusion again, something that Dermot said about the extent to which England is tied into these continental developments, and it certainly was, and confusion over what Luther actually did and represents. I mean, his legacy has become quite complex in the lights of reassessments of his misogyny and his anti-Semitism as a result of ecumenical dialogues between churches today that make remembering some of these sort of very acrimonious debates a little more awkward, perhaps. So just to wrap up, I mean, why do I think the Reformation is worth us paying attention to? Why did I decide to sort of devote my professional life, and as we all have, to the study of the Reformation? I mean, a personal answer, because I find it entirely fascinating, perhaps because as a 21st century atheist, I'm entirely absorbed by what questions of the power which religious ideas had to change the world in the 16th and 17th centuries, because I'm fascinated by the relationship between theology and the lives, beliefs, values and culture of ordinary people in the period, so again bringing it back to sort of ordinary people, because I think we owe it to the people of the past to seek to understand them and to rescue them from what E.P. Thompson called the enormous condescension of posterity, so to sort of, you know, give these people some credit. And because I think that through our inquiry of the past, we learn something about ourselves and our own society's values, beliefs, culture and identity. I think historical study invites us to view the world around us with the same critical perspectives with which we view the past, to interrogate received wisdom, to question unquestioned certainties, and to expose them as partisan, contingent and morally relative.
Well, that sums things up very nicely, so thank you very much for that. So, to begin with, I'd like to take you back to the last thing that you mentioned, actually, Jonathan, and to actually ask Alex and Dermot to comment on the 1517 anniversary, and to just sort of ask you why, again, you sort of think this might not have had the profile in the UK that it did sort of have in Europe.
Well, it's a German event, isn't it? And it actually has no relevance to the course of English history. The trouble is finding something which would be relevant. What would you take? 1533, which was the first break with Rome, or 1547, when a real Reformation began and with the accession of Edward VI, or 1558, when it's absolutely definitively established for good? None of these quite hack it as the beginning of the Reformation here. So that's why 1517 is quite useful. But it really doesn't ring bells here, as it does in the United States, because there's so much of a more of a Lutheran culture in their DNA. But it's a problem, and you can perfectly well understand why the great British public said 1517, what's that about?
Well, yes, I agree with that too, that I think there's a considerable amount of ambiguity in the 16th and 17th centuries themselves about when the Reformation begins, and that's carried on. I mean, some people in the 17th century talked about the accession of Elizabeth I in 1558 as the birthday of the gospel. So for them, that might have been the beginning of the Reformation. But I think it's also the reason why we haven't had so much impact here is because, as Dermot's already said, Lutheranism kind of became eclipsed in its contribution to the making of the English Reformation. And one of Dermot's own students has famously written an article called The Strange Death of Lutheran England.
Eric Ryrie,
by
name.
Indeed.
Yes.
Yeah. So I think Luther, is not a key figure in the contemporary and subsequent perceptions. I mean, he's remembered in some circles, but there's also embarrassment about Luther's views on the Eucharist, for example, and people complain or sort of excuse him for his rather backward views in this area. So I think there's a kind of long legacy of forgetting Luther that the current anniversary has perpetuated.
To return, I suppose, to something that Dermot was talking about earlier, about this idea of the European Reformations, do you think that we can talk about sort of one Reformation, or do you think that it's more accurate to sort of talk about Reformations plural?
Well, it is in England, because there are a series of opinions of the children of Henry VIII, all of which are different. So Edward VI, it's a driving reformed Reformation. That's where it's going. Mary, totally the opposite way around. Elizabeth, the prisoner of her own Reformation, would have liked something a bit more like the Lutherans. I mean, it's absolutely wrong to describe the Elizabethan settlement as a compromise between Catholicism and Protestantism. It wasn't. It was a compromise between two different sorts of Protestantisms, one reformed, the other Lutheran. So there are those Reformations, and there is also the popular Reformation, which would have been different, which we saw in the 1640s and 50s. Suddenly it's a free-for-all, and you see what a lot of the English people would have actually liked to have had as a Protestant church. 1660, you get something which you might almost say is Anglican. You can begin using the word Anglican properly for the church restored by Charles II. So yeah, a whole series of Reformations.
I think what I'd say is that we also need to think about the counter-reformation, the Catholic Reformation, that is a vigorous process, not only under Mary, sometimes described recently by Eamon Duffy as a kind of the most precocious counter-reformation in Europe, but also under Elizabeth, the very powerful attempts to reverse reformation by missionary priests trained in the Low Countries who returned to England with the Jesuits to try to bring about, you know, a reversal of this Protestant Reformation. So for them, there's no sense in which what's 1558 is the end point of this process. They're still hopeful well into the 17th century. And the whole politics of the 17th century is about fears of a reversal of Reformation, right up to the Glorious Revolution in 1689, which is, you know, widely now regarded as the end point, but I think is a reflection of the enormous instability, you know, created by the Reformation, and instability that still had the potential to move in different directions for more than 100 years after the events of the 1530s.
Mm. Yeah, I think I'd agree with everything that's been said, and that the sort of academic or sort of scholarly position is increasingly, there's a consensus that the English Reformation is a long Reformation, that phrase of the long Reformation, something that spills way beyond, you know, if you picked up a textbook in the 1960s, you know, 1558 is pretty much the kind of the end point, and there's a bit of an epilogue to sort of mop things up, but that's pretty much it. Whereas now we certainly see the Reformation as something that continues throughout the 16th century, informs the major political events of the 17th century, and continues to have sort of cultural repercussions and social repercussions from that point, you know, onwards. So in a way, 1558, it's the end point of the sort of the chopping and changing, the kind of the Tudor, you know, sort of the Tudor volley of, you know, confession from one position to another. But it's only the start of the process by which people can start to come to terms with the impact of all these changes. So 1558 is the point at which this kind of missile kind of lands in the lake, and then the ripples keep sort of spreading out for centuries to come.
You've all talked about the impact of the Reformation on ordinary people, which is obviously something that we should be interested in. But what I'm particularly interested to hear is what you think were the biggest changes to everyday piety that happened throughout the course of the Reformation, and what sort of time scale you think that this happened in, if anyone would like to comment on that particularly.
Well, one thing is that you far fewer modes of expressing your public piety. The monasteries have gone, the chantries have gone, the friars have gone. So basically, if you wish to express your religion in a public forum, it is the parish church. The cathedrals, which I've already mentioned, are actually peculiarly lacking in popularity, and they don't want to have a public mission. They're there as corporations which do their own thing. They don't affect public worship all that much. So it's the parish church or nothing. And that's new, because there are so many different ways of being a pious public Christian in medieval England, and that's been much narrowed.
I think I'd say that it's their experience of the setting for worship that's so fundamentally changed, that iconoclasm, official iconoclasm, as well as the unofficial iconoclasm, is totally transforming the settings for worship. And I think it's very significant to realize that on the eve of the Reformation, there's, up until the very last minute, people are investing in their churches. They're installing new forms of decoration that reflect the vibrancy and the vitality of piety in the late Middle Ages. And so sometimes it's the very same people who've installed things or seen their parents install things that are then being stripped away within their own generation. So I think those are, you know, really powerful effects, that what they see that in their churches has been totally transformed and has been brutally defaced in many instances. And I think that must have been the most palpable change alongside the process by which monasteries were physically dismantled, not just by the state, but also by ordinary people who took advantage of the opportunity to strip lead off the roofs, to take away building materials. So it's a real physical process as well as a change in hearts and minds.
I mean, I think I'd say two things. I definitely agree with that, but also, I mean, this is I've been lucky to co-supervise a student who's been doing a PhD on the material culture of the English parish church after the Reformation, and absolutely it's sort of transformed, but people do still find ways to kind of invest realise a variety of kind of civic, personal, familial kind of drivers and sort of to sort of display their identities in parish churches through things like seating, pulpits, communion tables, galleries, wall texts and these kinds. So there is stuff going on, but much reduced, I'd agree, and very viscerally shocking for that first generation
just
of people.
Just different, anyway.
Yeah, absolutely different. I mean, the other thing to think about that we have not mentioned Puritans yet. I've only sort of Puritanism into this a little bit is that, you know, one of the things that the English Reformation sort of results in is a kind of culture war, I guess, between people who take the Reformation very seriously and the mission of Reformation and consider the Elizabethan church but halfly reformed and want to go the full hog and want to turn England into Calvin's Geneva with its consistories and its discipline and its kind of its very sort of pure form of worship. And those people who still inhabit a sort of a traditional culture more vested in values of good fellowship and sociability and drinking in the alehouse and games and sports and that kind of thing. And so, you know, these people, these two groups, and it's not really two groups, it's a spectrum, but for ease of discussion, these two groups have very different ideas of what it means to be a good Protestant, to demonstrate piety publicly. For one of these groups, you know, you need to spend Sundays praying and singing psalms and reading the Bible and discussing the sermon and, you know, meditating on scripture and things like that. For another group, it's perfectly acceptable to go to the church and hear the sermon and then go off down the pub and have a game of football afterwards. So there are different, it creates different sort of paradigms of religiosity and what it actually means to be a Christian in post-Reformation England.
Thank you. And just a final question from me. We've talked about the survival of archival material and how this has shaped the narrative of the Reformation. I just wondered if you could all give a sort of comment on how this has impacted on your own research of the Reformation.
Well, I could point to Thomas Cromwell with a huge, huge archive confiscated at his death. It's very odd. Thousands on thousands of documents from his in tray, the things written to him. And you notice when working through it that the out tray is missing. And you might think that that's natural, but no, it isn't, because we also have another archive here, confiscated exactly the same time from Lord Lyle in Calais, which is beautifully organised between in tray and out tray. And what you do with the out tray is keep the very last draft that you gave to your clerk before you said, okay, that's fine, just do a final version to go out. You keep that. Now, that's completely missing in Cromwell's archive. Lord Lyle was totally a disorganized, inefficient sort of guy, and yet his archive is organized like that. So clearly Cromwell's was too. And we have one distinctive record from him, his remembrances, what I must do this week, which was clearly a part of the archive. So there was an out tray archive. What happened to it? I think the household, having heard that he was about to be arrested, burnt it. So when they gave this huge archive to the king, they just gave him the in tray, on the grounds that what incriminates you is what is in your out tray, not what people write to you. It was a good try. In other words, it didn't work, but it was a good try. And that's why this very peculiar quality, we never hear his voice. Think of Hilary Mantel's novel. He's he. And that is a very perceptive comment on the archive. You're always seeing him through other people's eyes.
I think I would also comment on my current preoccupation is, which is I'm interested in what I'm calling the reformation of the generations, the role of generations, of families, and so on in Reformation, how they perceived that Reformation, how they themselves shaped that Reformation. And one of the things that's really struck me as I've been wending my way around various different archives, that it suddenly dawned upon me, is how much we owe the survival of documentation about the Reformation to the family and to processes of generational transmission, that people keep things that are meaningful to them because of their parents or their grandparents or their children or whatever. And it's so so much of the archives that survive are testimonies to those processes of sentiment and of love and affection and of preserving memory of people, but in the process preserving memory of events as well.
I think I'd go back to an earlier project, my sort of doctoral research, which involved looking at evidence for music in Elizabethan parish churches. And I did a sort of a national survey of church wardens' accounts. And I found some really interesting stuff about, you know, parishes that kept their organs well into the 1570s, 1580s, sometimes even later, that paid wages for singing men and choristers and maintained choirs. So this sort of contradicted the previous wisdom that all the choirs and organs were sort of, you know, got rid of as soon as Elizabeth came to the throne. So all this kind of great information about sort of musical resources, no evidence at all as to what they were doing. So nothing, when were they playing the organs, what were they playing, what were the choir singing, when were they singing it, all this. So that aspect of practice was completely absent, because all you get are the payments for maintenance, or usually for beer or wine for the singers. That seems to be quite a recurring expense. And nothing at all, no records about what they were actually doing. So that was very frustrating. Sometimes there are just gaps that you can't get any further than that, because the records don't exist.
Thank you. No, that's great. Well, some really insightful answers to those questions. Thank you so much to our fantastic speakers who have given us an absolutely wonderful series of reflections on the Reformation. I hope you'll join me in thanking them properly.
This podcast is copyright to the National Archives, all rights reserved. It is available for reuse under the terms of the Open Government License.